Because they could be popey or they could be soaty.
Hello and welcome to Anti-Pontifax. I'm Fry.
And I'm Bree, ranking all of the antipopes from Hippolytus to Felix V. And this is our first antipope episode, Hippolytus. As we know him, the little bitch.
Yeah. Hippopotalidus.
Hippopotamus. This is going to likely be an episode where we're going to have a lot to say compared to some of the antipopes, but before we can do that, we need to outline what we're going to be ranking these popes on, so get ready for some new categories.
Popum Justificum.
So this category is going to be justifications for their schism and why they're setting themselves up as an antipope. Basically, we are going to be scoring them on whether or not we think they have a good reason or not. Maybe good, maybe bad, maybe they had a point. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they were just salty. This is how we're going to rate them.
Ecclesias impetus.
So this category will give them points based on the impact that they actually have on the church. And they are going to get more points if they did things like weaken the church, and less points if they actually strengthened the church who rallied against them. Basically, what impact this particular antipope has on Christian history as a whole.
Facium scleratus.
This is the unholy face.
Yes.
What did they look like? Oh, shocker. We're going to score this the same way that we do for Facium Sanctus. They are going to get a score out of 10, and then we're going to divide it by 4. So they don't get a lot of points if they have a really unusual face or depiction, which we should definitely mention for this episode in particular. So
is his face weird?
He doesn't have necessarily a weird face, but the images that we're going to look at are weird.
All right.
They're so weird.
Tempus non pontificus.
So, how much time were they an antipope for? Did they outlast a papacy? How many papacies did they last for?
Did they get extra points for how many papacies they checked off?
That would be a lot of bonus points for some of these guys, so I don't know if I want to give them extra points, but we'll score it in the same kind of fashion and see how they do. And we will talk about, like, which papacies they were adjacent to. Some of them more than others.
Hey, so it's canon bonus round time. No fanfare.
Some of these antipopes are saints, if you can believe it or not.
I don't know if I believe it.
Well, we've already talked about Hippolytus being one, so that's already a thing.
I know, I'm fighting it.
He's not the patron saint of anything good, really, but, I mean, what's a good thing to be a patron saint of? I'm not quite sure.
I don't know, kittens?
Better than horses, I guess. Ooh, that's controversial, isn't it?
Puppos?
Oh, I would want to be patron saint of puppies. Yes, or das.
Pope? Or nope? Or soap?
Or soat. Pope or nope. So, this is instead of a papal bull, because they were never pope and don't get to actually get one of those, we're going to ask, are they better than the pope that they came up against? So this could lead to some interesting debate. I think there will be antipopes who will get yeses in this category. So any antipope that actually gets a yes in this category instead of a nope, then we're going to give them front row tickets to the final battle at the Pearly Gates.
Ooh.
Maybe one of them will jump in there if they got like a really good score or something.
That'd be some wild combo breaker.
Who's the best pope? Who's the popiest pope? Well, it was the antipope.
You done fucked up, church.
It could happen. So let's dig right into Hippolytus, or Hippopotamus, or the little bitch. So find out if the rest of his life is a reflection of what we already have talked about for him. Hippolytus was probably born in Rome, or the surrounding areas around Rome, sometime around 170, which would put him being born during the papacy of Pope Soter or maybe Eleutherius. We don't know a whole lot about his early life, but we can assume that he entered the church relatively early since we know he's going to go on and have quite a prolific career in the church. So he's got to get in there early so he can start messing things up. Photius I of Constantinople the future patriarch of Constantinople in the 9th century, wrote about Hippolytus in his Bibliotheca, setting that in his early church study, Hippolytus was a student of Irenaeus, our great, great source that we've been talking about and only just recently lost to death. And we should also remember that Irenaeus had been greatly influenced by Polycarp in his youth. This is a direct line of supremely important and influential thinkers in the church, and one line of thinkers that is known for being unyieldingly stubborn, very focused on moral rigorism and combating heresy in the church. This is setting him up for what kind of person that he's going to be in the future, even if he's not a direct student of this lineage, because some historians will question this as fact. He was, at very least, most influenced by Irenaeus and Polycarp, and saw himself as a protege of what they were putting forth. This is how we need to conceive of Hippolytus and his theological ideas and his actions, because he comes from a line of people that are known for having very steadfast opinions and not changing those opinions when they're not popular. Remember Polycarp and Easter. Oh God.
We're not going to cut from the quarter decimans because I'm a stubborn old man.
And because all of the important people before me died as quarter decimans, and so I will be one of them, the least of you all. He's very active in the church, and by the time of Zephyrinus's early papacy, we have mentioned that he's a presbyter and that he's out preaching in the world. So while Zephyrinus is allegedly being a simple man of no education, Hippolytus is distinguishing himself as being learned and eloquent and fancy.
I'm shaking my head.
Yeah. And I mean, we have to remember that the comments about Zephyrinus being simple and unlearned and no education all come from Hippolytus himself. So even though it's not Hippolytus calling himself learned and eloquent, because this actually comes from Jerome, who is actually relaying this around the year 212, we know that this is kind of the distinction that's being made. And we also know that in 212, Origen, the speculative theologian that we discussed a couple episodes ago, he actually heard Hippolytus preach when he was young, and it had a huge effect on him, so maybe Hippolytus is just getting on with all the heretics, even if he doesn't like it.
He's the new up-and-coming Paul there.
I think he would love that, really. Because, you know, Paul was pretty staunchly rigorous, too, with his morals, so.
Paul would have been the first anti-pope if Paul had given that much of a fuck.
Oh, that is so true. If that bro fight had gone one step further, this bonus episode would have started a long time ago. Okay, so there's also some sources that refer to Hippolytus as a bishop, and this would also make sense considering that what happens later on, he is in the running for pope, and at that point in history, it does seem like you actually had to be a bishop to be considered being pope. But the weird thing is that no one mentions exactly where Hippolytus is a bishop of. And that's weird. Like, we know, usually we have it as what city that they're a bishop of, and either no one knew by the time that these sources are being written, or it's been lost to history, or maybe he wasn't a bishop at all.
Shrouded in antiquity.
Yeah, a little bit. And I mean, we're gonna get into why that is a little bit later on, but yeah, nobody knows exactly where he was a bishop for. There's one source that suggests he might have been the bishop of Porto, which is the Italian village, not the Portuguese city. And we do have sources from the future Pope Gelasius, who refers to him as the bishop of Bostra in Syria. But that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because he'd be way, way, way too far away to be having such a direct impact in Rome during this time. The church is just way too young and too small for bishops to be hanging out in Rome if they had congregations to oversee in Syria. The other thing that Hippolytus does in the time of Zephyrinus' papacy is that he becomes the head of a theological school, which he espoused his ideas on the divine logos. And because of that, this is probably a good as place as any to discuss the two theological philosophies that are going to be most important in understanding Hippolytus as a person and as a theologian, and then, of course, as an antipope. So we're not going to get into all of his ideas, and we're not going to dig into these in huge length, because all of the important ones that are going to be major, major theological discussions are going to come out in our regular series as we go. But for now, we're going to hit the highlights as they mattered to Hippolytus. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
Well, we're going to start on a high note with moral rigorism.
Ooh.
I know. It sounds so exciting. So
sounds like a good time. Parties for all.
Such a good time. Hippolytus is definitely a rigorist, and he is going to be the first of many rigorists who are going to come into conflict with a church that might be more accepting than they are. So essentially, rigorism is the moralists who want to out-moral the church. They believe that the church needs to be free of sin wherever and whenever possible, and that grave sin must be cast out because no level of penance could undo their stain. They want to be the holiest men in the holy church and look down their nose at everyone else.
Ugh, seems like a horrible existence.
Yeah, and this is literally one of his main philosophies.
Just the church neckbeards going on here.
Exactly. They're basically virtue signalers. They're putting it out there. They want everybody to know that I am better than you because look at what I can do. Are you liking him any more than you did?
I mean, I didn't like him to start with, but now he's Sir Neckbeard, the holiest.
And it's gonna get worse. The second one is the Logos theory, and this is definitely more theological and doctrinal, so we have covered this in the main episode when we did Zephyrinus, so hopefully we can just kind of blow through as a refresher without any cerebral carnage trying to explain this all. So the idea of the divine logos, or the word, which unified God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit as one sort of entity, but also as plural from one another. So they're the same, but different. They would all share the Godhead, which is like the divinity, the divine spark, but the nature of Christ the Son is different or slightly different than the nature of God the Father. This comes out at the time of Hippolytus as a very sort of Trinitarian look and will be the foundation of where things go. And it's mostly in contrast to the adoptionists who believed that Jesus was just a man until his baptism, and he wasn't God until his resurrection. So that basically means that they are both holy, God and Jesus are holy, but they're different. And Hippolytus believes that the divine logos makes Jesus divine always and forever from the very beginning of time. And so that kind of is a direct stab at the adoptionist. And then it's also kind of a direct stab at the modalists, because they wanted everything to be simple and have one God and the Holy Spirit and then Christ be all one and the same with no distinction whatsoever. So when Christ the Son was crucified, it was also God the Father, because Christ is an incarnation of God. Whereas Hippolytus, again, would argue that Christ the Son was crucified, but God the Father was not, because Christ, though the same as God, was more of an incarnation of the Logos rather than the original Godhead. This is an issue that we're literally going to deal with up until the Council of Nicaea, and it's going to become the massive controversy in the church that is going to replace everything Easter. So it doesn't have to be settled at this point. And we also have to remember that though this is credited very strongly to Hippolytus, and this is what he's writing about and he's espousing and he's teaching in his school, this is not purely his original work. He didn't create this theology. He's just a very strong proponent of it. This concept was also being perpetuated by Saint Ignatius and Justin the Martyr and Irenaeus and many others. So Hippolytus is just the most vehement supporter at the time, and he's the one who's getting into fights about it, and so he's the loudest voice going on. And so, because he's the one getting into fights about it, this is where he's going to start turning into a salty fighty man.
Well, I suppose if everybody's like, no, we don't believe that, and he's like, I believe this so hard.
And what's more is even the people who might have agreed with him were like, this is confusing.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
Like, it's clearly a confusing concept if you're trying to explain it to people on a basic theological level, let alone with all of the other aspects of biblical doctrine.
Yeah. And, like, I learned, you know, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit when I was, like, in kindergarten. And at that point, you just sort of accept things. And I've never had to, like, revisit it thought-wise.
Yeah, you've never had to ask yourself where the difference in divinity is or where the Godhead is or what the term consubstantial means or any of those things.
Nope. I was just a kindergartner. Sky's blue. God's got three things going on.
And they're not all quite the same.
Nope.
He is believing this so hard, and people are either not agreeing with him, or they're confused by him. And remember, he is running his religious school at this time, teaching this theology, which, again, super confusing. And then, it's not the only religious school that exists. So, we have two other theologians called Cleomenes and Sabellius, who are also in Rome at the time and also have their own religious theological ideas, and they establish a rival religious school where they are teaching what is modalism, right? This idea of, yeah, everything's the same, man. You don't have to differentiate between the Son, the Father, the Holy Spirit. It really doesn't matter. It's all the same because it's all God. It's all divinity. And so this absolutely infuriates Hippolytus, who sees their teachings as heresy.
Ooh, he's just gonna go straight to heresy now.
And eventually, to be clear, so will the rest of the church. Like, modalism will eventually be declared heresy, but it's much later on. At this time, Hippolytus is steaming about it. He thinks it's straight up heresy. He goes to Pope Zephyrinus to get them shut down.
Oh yeah, and then Zephyrinus does not.
Yeah, no, he's not into that. He doesn't really want to take a firm stance on one side or the other, and he's not the only one. Many later church historians are going to look back on this conflict, and they will agree with Zephyrinus that the quote-unquote heresy of the modalists was not immediately apparent, right? It just seems like a simple idea that unifies all the natures of divinity. But to be clear, Zephyrinus didn't side with the modalists either. He just responded by stating, indeed, there is only one God, and indeed, this God is also Jesus, but indeed, it was the Son who died for the salvation of humanity and not the Father. So he's not shutting down or excommunicating someone, but he's like, yeah, okay, this is a complicated issue and we haven't figured it all out. And this does not make Hippolytus happy, and so he starts a straight-up smear campaign.
Ooh.
Yeah, he's totally infuriated with Pope Zephyrinus, and he wants the world to know that this platitude-giving pope is clearly an uneducated and weak leader who is unworthy of his position, and must also definitely be a heretic modalist, and definitely doesn't think for himself. He must be accepting bribes and accepting bad counsel from foul men, like that of Calixtus.
Oh man, that's just a step too far. Like, let's go to the straight extreme.
Oh, he totally grabbed it and ran with it. He's like, oh, you're not going to agree with me? I'm going to say every bad thing I can think about you. Oh, and you have that dude Calixtus? I hate him too. And we have to remember that Zephyrinus had made Calixtus his archdeacon at this time.
I think Hippolytus wanted to be the archdeacon and was super jelly.
Oh, probably. I mean, maybe that makes sense because we really have no idea why Hippolytus hated Calixtus so much. If there was a conflict between the two men directly, like if they had had some sort of personal falling out, it's been shrouded in antiquity.
Nah, he was just brown-nosing the Pope, and then the Pope was like, I'm not paying attention to you, and then he got mad.
Right? It seems like if they had a personal fight, it would be something that Hippolytus would want recorded in his, like, burn book. more than likely the hatred that Hippolytus has is, if not about position, maybe it's about the fact that this, we have Hippolytus being this moral rigorist, and Calixtus has a shady past of being arrested and losing church funds and fighting in a synagogue and ending up in the mines of Sardinia and getting free of those mines and living off a pension from Pope Victor. You know, all the things that a rigid rigorist would tut-tut about and clutch their pearls and be very upset about. Maybe it's that. We don't know. Then Pope Zephyrinus dies in 217, and it's time to elect a new pope. And if the sources of the time are to be believed, it's clear that Hippolytus thought that he was absolutely the choice for successor.
Is it one of those, like, and then the winner is, and he, like, stands up, but then it's not him?
Oh, 100%. And like, we have to, for a moment, put ourselves in his shoes, because honestly, he wouldn't have been a terribly bad choice for popes, because he was one of the most learned members of the clergy, and he was definitely one of the most prolific writers at the time on ecclesiastical law and canon, so big points for the church. But then he categorically loses the election to Calixtus.
Do they have vote numbers?
It always just says that Calixtus was elected in majority.
Okay. It might be interesting to see the numbers. If they weren't shrouded in antiquity.
Oh, all of these shrouds, man. But we could say at this point, considering that Hippolytus would have been a good choice, that the reason he is losing by a landslide is that he's self-righteous and uncompromising, and no one likes him. So, rather than using this as a time of self-reflection and growth, or to consider if maybe he should take a more Christ-like, forgiving stance towards sinners and Christians with different ideas than him, he just flips out and refuses to recognize Calixtus as pope and immediately leaves the church.
Goodbye.
And it's not exactly like a bye Felicia moment, because he did have some support in the church, and mostly from other rigorists who saw Calixtus's election as a slippery slope into lax morality. So there are some clergymen who leave the church with Hippolytus and consecrate him as their bishop of Rome, creating the first antipope of the history of the church, which we have to imagine made him so smug. Could you imagine all of the smug?
Yeah.
We're now in schism. We've already looked at what that was like for the church and Calixtus through his papacy. We now get to look at antipope Hippolytus's congregations and what they looked like. First off, this may go without saying, but it is important to acknowledge that they didn't see themselves as being anti-church. They saw themselves as being the true Catholic way, and very significantly, Hippolytus does style himself as the successor of the apostles. So he's not seeing himself as a rival to the pope, he is seeing himself as the successor in that line. He just thinks that these other people are misguided and they will eventually come around to him as the actual successor of the apostles. So we know how important this idea of apostolic succession is and how it's been a critical justification for the primacy of the pope this whole time. So we are seeing in action how important that was and how much weight that held, that he was using that claim to try and legitimize himself. So that's a really big deal. Now, according to the theologian George Salmon, who is writing in the 19th century, Hippolytus's congregation was in large part Greek-speaking Christians who lived in Rome. And we also have historian Alan Brent, who wrote Hippolytus and the Roman Church in the 3rd century, Communities in Tension Before the Emergence of a Monarch Bishop, describes Hippolytus's congregation as sort of a house church system inspired by the schools of Greek philosophy, where the flock would gather around its compelling leader in a much more informal type setup. And we don't really know if this style of congregation that Hippolytus is having is influenced by the heavy Greek speaking following that he had, or whether the Greek style drew the Greek followers to it. What came first, the Greek people or the Greek style? We don't really know. Could just be coincidental, but He definitely has a lot of Greeks following him, and they're taking on a very Greek style of teaching and learning and having sermons. So,
if the shoe fits, man.
Yeah, pretty much. And as anti-pope, besides holding these religious gatherings to carry on what they felt was the correct moral and theological standing for the church, Hippolytus continues to write on theology and against heresy, and he's going after Sibelius and Cleomenes, of course, and the modalists, and he's going after the adoptionists led by Theodotus, the leather seller, and Theodotus, the money changer. Not the same dude.
I still think it's probably the same dude, just upgraded, doing well in business.
Maybe he faked his own death so he could come back and relead his cult from a different perspective.
I'd do it.
You would. And most importantly, he's also going after the Pope, because he's so mad about everything that Calixtus does. So, like with Zephyrinus, he goes full-scale character attack on Calixtus in his text that he calls The Refutation of All Heresies, which is referred to today as the Philosopha Magna. So, we've seen most of what he said about Calixtus in Calixtus's episode, but essentially he recounts his past in the most unflattering ways, paints Calixtus as scheming and bribing and manipulative and having been the puppet master who overtook Zephyrinus's ignorant sensibilities to push his own agenda. He also said that Calixtus was a modalist because he had allowed certain people back into the church that Hippolytus had thought he had the right to excommunicate. They came to his religious school, he goes, you don't have the right ideas, you're excommunicated, and Calixtus went, nah, you're still good. And that made Hippolytus very angry. And this really doesn't make any sense to think that Calixtus must be a modalist because he actually condemns modalists from the church, including Sibelius, who he casts out. So clearly, not a modalist. This just seems to be, like, Hippolytus's go-to insult. You're a modalist! You don't agree with me, you must be a modalist! And then, of course, we have Calixtus extending the church policy on the absolution of sins to include the grave sins such as adultery and murder. And he passes that ordination, which allows Roman citizens to marry their slaves and have that marriage be valid. And, of course, this just absolutely scandalizes the anti-pope, who cannot believe that the church would actually be allowing these sinners to retain communion. The moral laxity of the church is out of control. The pope is okay with slave marriage and adultery. He must also be okay with contraception and abortion, too.
Oh yeah, don't forget. It's all the same.
And he writes that hasty polemic to condemn the new ordinations, and even though we quoted this in the main episode, it's too good to leave out, because this is what Hippolytus has to say about that. Whence women, reputed believers, began to resort to drugs for producing sterility and to gird themselves round their bellies so to expel what was being conceived on account of their not wishing to have a child either by a slave or any paltry fellow for the sake of their family and excessive wealth.
He's the paltry fellow.
He is the paltry fellow. Behold, into how great impiety that lawless one has proceeded by inculcating adultery and murder at the same time. And withal, after such audacious acts, they lost all to shame, attempt to call themselves a Catholic church. Madman. So salty. And of course, we know that Hippolytus doesn't give up the rivalry when Calixtus dies and Pope Urban is elevated. And even though he doesn't go after Urban directly, at this time, the official publication of his Philosopha Magna comes out, full of the criticisms and attacks that Hippolytus has been leveling at the papacy, and at the same time he's trying to win favor with the Christian-tolerant imperial family by writing them directly and dedicating another one of his books, The Resurrection, to Alexander Severus's mother, Julia Mamia. Remember we said we don't like getting shitty poetry from men?
Yep, but what about religious texts?
Well, if he wanted any special response to that. He didn't really get one, so. But he's making an active effort to undermine the Pope and the Catholic Church in a time that is otherwise relatively peaceful, and that feels like the greatest jerk move, so We actually don't see the royal family giving him any favor, especially since we see Alexander Severus dedicating the land for the Basilica di Santa Maria in Trastevere to the church rather than to Hippolytus. So, you know, he's seeing right through it, perhaps. But Hippolytus didn't give up, and he attempts to continue to grow his congregation to rival the church in Rome. He holds ceremonies, he consecrates members to his clergy, he writes treatises, and he's preaching in public, of course.
Imagine preaching in private.
Well, I mean, he had these house churches, but he's also going out and doing this big thing. And this gets him noticed by the new emperor, Maximinus Thrax, who has completely overturned all of the toleration of Alexander Severus and is launching an empire-wide campaign of Christian persecution.
He's murdered so many of our people already.
Especially church leaders. So he's going straight for those ones at the top. And that means that Hippolytus gets arrested and is immediately exiled to the mines in Tavolara in Sardinia, along with his chief rival, the newly appointed Pope Pontian. Now, we've discussed many times with this theme, a sentence to the mines is a swift and torturous death sentence with added manual labor that you work to see yourself to death. I think we need to, like, update our death choices that we keep talking about. Is it noms or beheading or mines at this point? Always something. I don't think I would choose mines.
That seems like a bad time.
So, before they can die, Pontian and Hippolytus are subject to some brutal, back-breaking labor in extreme conditions and very poor treatment and very little food. And like we discussed in Pontian's episode, if the sources are to be believed, then the two men are able to put aside their differences and reconcile in the face of their adversity before they die. Now, if this happened at all, we could speculate that maybe this was a pact made to ensure that the church stayed unified in the face of these persecutions. And one source on Hippolytus actually does mention that Hippolytus did manage to get the word out, quote, to exhort his followers to unite with Rome.
Oh, he did the thing.
He did the thing, and we don't have any evidence that Pontian did the same, but perhaps this does make the reconciliation story a little bit more valid. Now, interesting enough, the same source that says this about Hippolytus also mentions that in the future commemoration of Hippolytus within the church as a martyr, he's mentioned as a priest of the church rather than a bishop. That could be inferred that if he was accepted back into the church on the base of this reconciliation right before they all died, that he still kind of had that demotion about him. He's being brought back on the barest level of church clergy because he hasn't regained his bishop status. This was a guy who left the church, but he came back last minute. Maybe he doesn't deserve to be recognized as a bishop, maybe just a priest.
That's fair. So we got retroactively demoted?
Potentially. At least this is the way it's interpreted in the years that it is following Hippolytus' death. This is how they look at it. And then he dies. But Pontian dies first, almost immediately after they arrive in the mines.
I'm really shocked by that, because Pontian was a young man who I would assume would be fit and spry.
Yeah, but it also sounds like they beat him to death with sticks. So they might have been like, you're a pope man, let's deal with you first.
Sticks into the equation makes a lot more sense.
There's more cudgeling happening.
On and about the head region.
Probably, we can imagine. And from what we can understand, Hippolytus wasn't that far behind him, so it wasn't like a super long period of time. But if we are to believe the poet Prudentius's account, Hippolytus's death was definitely more shocking and brutal, and this is because his captors decided to take inspiration from the mythological Hippolytus and drag Hippolytus to death with wild horses. And interestingly, the depictions that come out of this story aren't just of a man being dragged, but usually they're the ones where, like, the hands and the feet are tied to different horses and they're sent off in opposite directions.
Well, what's that? That's called, like, drawing and quartering, right?
Yeah, essentially he's being drawn and quartered in most of these examples, or just ripped in half. So remember when I said we were going to look at some weird pictures?
Ah, damn. Is it the guy who draws really gross stuff? Does he do a painting? What's his name?
Oh, you mean Caravaggio.
There we go. Okay.
No, these are the ones will be a lot earlier than Caravaggio's work.
Okay, because his work is really gross. So I don't want to see a drawn and quartered painting by
Caravaggio. Oh, have you seen his Judith slaying Holofernes or his Medusa?
No.
Oh, I know what we're doing after this episode.
We're just looking at gross paintings? Cool.
Yeah, because the one I showed you is by far not the grossest.
Pretty gross.
Maybe Hippolytus was torn to pieces, and Prudentius actually tells us that there was a picture of this on Hippolytus's tomb. Maybe he died this way because his captors enjoyed the irony, or maybe they thought it was great because his name means horse turned loose and it's too funny. Or maybe he was just beaten with sticks and the story got preserved on account of the mythological tie. Speaking of his tomb, when Fabian becomes pope in 236, he has the bodies of Pontian and Hippolytus brought back to Rome for a proper burial in honor of their martyrdom. And according to the Liber Pontificalis, Hippolytus is interred in a cemetery on the Via Tiburtina, and a funeral service was overseen by Justin the Confessor, who we mentioned in Pontian's episode because he oversees many funerals of martyrs that would be canonized. So not just Hippolytus, but like St. Lawrence and the future Pope Sixtus II, and he's going to get martyred later on and canonized.
He can't oversee his own funeral.
Nope, he can't, but he's also going to end up canonized with these people, so it's a thing. Later on in the 4th century, Hippolytus's grave was dedicated with an inscription by Pope Damasus I, who got the details of his life wrong and describes him as a follower of a completely different schism that we're going to deal with pretty quickly. And so rather than he's the anti-pope and the leader of the schism, no, he's just a follower of this other dude. And this inscription is present at the time that the tomb was rediscovered by Giovanni de Rossi in 1882. And clearly Prudentius had also seen this inscription because his poem, The Passion of Saint Hippolytus, also describes Hippolytus this way. So again, if he was wrong about this, maybe he was wrong about the means of death too. Something to point out. There's a lot of confusion about Hippolytus, and there's a reason for that. And this is mainly due to the fact that very shortly after his death, the details of Hippolytus's life and his theology are, for the most part, forgotten. Completely forgotten. This guy pretty much goes into obscurity right away. And the reason for this is he had left the main body of the church, so the only people who care about Christians at this time are Christians. But the big reason is that all of Hippolytus' work was written in Greek, and Greek at this time was on its way out as the language of the church. You know, we've talked about the implementation of Latin since Pope Victor. He's out of the church. No other Christians are trying to preserve him because he was kind of on the outside. The pagans of Rome don't give a shit. And he's writing in Greek. So he gets forgotten for a very, very long time. You know, this leads to the confusions that he was a follower of a different schism. Then that gets twisted into he was a soldier that was converted by St. Lawrence. And there was also another martyr called Hippolytus. And up until the time of Pope Pius IV in the 1500s, the two were kind of melded together into a figure. That, you know, the story was he served as the Bishop of Portus and was martyred under Alexander Severus by being drowned in a well. None of which is likely for our Hippolytus, so. Confusions. But these confusions finally had an end in 1551 when a 3rd century marble statue was discovered within the cemetery of the Via Tiburtina of Hippolytus. It's a man sitting on a large seat. And on the sides of the seat in the sculpture are inscribed a list of Hippolytus's writings, as well as a paschal cycle, which is a calendar representing the future dates of the holidays around Easter, like Lent and Easter and Holy Week, that had been calculated out by Hippolytus. The man in the statue was thought to be Hippolytus, and since he would have been venerated after his martyrdom, and there's this renewed interest on his position in the church, and his writings start to clear up some of the confusion. And if you want to see this statue, it is in the Lateran Museum, so you can go see it. I saw it. It's cool.
We'll have to go to Rome someday.
Together this time.
Together to Rome.
So just to wrap up this discussion on Hippolytus, before we rate him, we're going to briefly touch on the writings that are verified to be by him in the statue. And he wrote mostly on canon law and theology, so we're going to touch on the significant ones. His best preserved works are the Commentary on the Prophet Daniel and the Commentary on the Song of Songs. The former is an interpretation of the biblical Daniel's prophecies, and the latter is the earliest Christian instruction that's been found on the post-baptismal rite of anointing with oil.
That's Daniel of the Noms?
I imagine so. I think that's the only biblical Daniel I can think of.
I mean, that's the only one I can think of, so...
We're gonna go with it. Daniel of the Noms, and he's going to interpret his prophecy. He also wrote two treatises, one called On the Christ and Antichrist, which was an interpretation of biblical prophecies that focused heavily on what they might mean for his own time, and the Apostolic Tradition, which contains the earliest recorded ritual of ordination, and chronicles the world in a Christian perspective from the time of the creation up till his own time. That one's going to be hugely influential, and the modern ordination ritual that still happens in the church is based on that one that's in Hippolytus' writing. It gets updated by Pope Paul VI in the 1960s, you know, Vatican II, but up until that point, that's what it was entirely based on and still kind of is.
That is kind of cool, considering he's...
anti-pope man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he did write a lot of theology before that time, so... his most important and main work was called The Refutation of All Heresies, which is his attacks on Zephyrinus, Calixtus, the Modalists, the Monarchianists, the Theodotians, the Adoptionists, Hellenic philosophers, and any other heretic he could find. It's 10 books long. Books 2 and 3 have been lost. And funnily enough, this whole work was lost until its discovery in 1842.
Where was it?
It was in a Armenian monastery. It was discovered by Maimonides Minos.
That's a name.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one just looking at it, but that's what it says. At the time, the authorship was actually unclear. Nobody knew who wrote this thing. It was attributed to Origen, and it was given the title Philosophemena.
That makes sense if you're going to assume it's by someone from that era.
Yeah, so they gave it to him, but eventually they did credit it back to Hippolytus. And this is where we really start to understand, again, who he was as a person. So he'd been forgotten for nearly 1,500 years before we really got this clear picture of him. So that's crazy. And now we can rate him.
Ooh.
Are you ready?
No. Papam Justificum.
So, his justifications for his schism and setting himself up as antipope. Did he have a good reason? Well,
he was sticking to his guns, at least, is, like, part of it seems kind of petty, and then part of it seems like he's really sticking to his guns. He is the lawful good cleric.
I think that if you look at what mostly his reason comes down to, I think it's the moral rigorist piece. He's not leaving because he believes heretical things. You know, his viewpoint is what's going to be important to the church. He's leaving because he's a moralist who is scandalized by church forgiveness. He wants a harsher disciplinary church who expels grave sinners. He doesn't believe that the Pope should have the power to absolve those sins. And he wasn't elected on his own. Those are pretty much the main reasons that he's arguing against the church. And so, yes, he's sticking to his guns so, so, so hard. But do you think those were good guns? Because I don't.
I mean, he had some all right ideas.
He had a lot of great theological ideas, but those weren't the ones that the church was coming up against. He's leaving on moral reasons.
Yeah, and did the forgiveness in the churches turn the other cheek and,
mm-hmm.
you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, those are big things in the church.
So, yeah, I mean, he's definitely sticking to his guns, so I have to give him at least a point for that.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, I'll give him, like, 2 points. He's sticking to his guns. They may not be the correct guns to arm yourself for the battle of your soul, but he's still got them.
My answer to this is, why gun when you can not gun? Because I think that the guns he's sticking to are really not good guns. I mean, I understand feeling strongly about things like adultery and murder, but I do not think that if you're following the whole Christ is a forgiver, Christ is all about saving people from their sins, it doesn't seem like a good logic for me in the church. So I can only give him a 2 as well, and that's the best that I can do. I'm almost stretching it. I'm being a little sympathetic. So he's only going to get a 4 for Papam Justificum. That's okay.
Ecclesius Impetus.
What impact does he have on the church? Does he weaken the church? Does he strengthen the church? What was his personal impact? Well, he is one of the most important 3rd century theologians. He is one of the most prolific writers in the Roman church in the pre-Constantinian era. He's probably tied with Origen. It's just that Origen seems to be more controversial. So in terms of what he was actually writing about theology, huge.
At least that part, he's definitely done a huge, huge impact.
His ordination is what the current ordination is on. Do I think he had a lasting impact on weakening the church? I don't. I think he separated for a little bit. He might have been a thorn in the church's side, but the church was never really threatened by Hippolytus. So he's not going to score high in terms of the damage that he did to the church, but he is going to score high for me because he had a personal impact on the church. I'm going to break it in half the way that I'm going to score it here. So out of 10, not a threat to the church, he's getting 0 for that, but he's getting the rest of the half, so he's getting a full 5 for his personal impact from me.
All right, yeah, that's what I was thinking, like, break it in half. He definitely impacted fully.
Oh, hugely. So I think in that way, even though he didn't threaten the church, he definitely left his mark. So 10 for Ecclesius Impetus.
Facium scleratus.
Are you ready to look at some weird pictures?
Yeah, let's look at this man and his horses.
I'm going to show you the statue, and this is what we're actually going to give him his looks point on. It's decent.
He kind of looks like Bob Ross.
I feel like that's worthy of a good score.
Doesn't he? Look at him.
Kind of, yeah. I can see it.
If Bob Ross and Santa had a baby.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. I don't think he's any more impressive than some of the popes we've been looking at.
No, I'll give him like a 4.
Yeah, I'm going to give him a 3, I think. I like that it's a sculpture, though, and it's so detailed from the 3rd century. No, I'm going to give him a 4 for that. That's better.
Look at the nice drapery on his legs.
Yeah, so he will get a total score of 2 for Facium scleratus. But now we get to look at the weird ones.
All right.
I'm going to show you the oldest depiction of his martyrdom, and there it is.
It looks like a 3-year-old drew it.
It does. Yeah, you can imagine this on some stone. He's naked while being pulled apart.
He is, but he does not have any dangly bits.
Nope. He looks kind of sad about it.
I would be sad about it.
But he doesn't look like he's in agony.
He's also not tied to anything. He's just sort of floating in air between two horses.
This artist is missing some detail, so.
Also, they're definitely donkeys and not horses with the cloven hooves and the tail.
I feel like that's an extra insult there. He's not dragged to death by wild horses, but donkeys. This one's a little bit later on in history, and, yeah, it's a little bit more detailed.
Okay. That's the, like, standard, like, Napoleonic horses galloping. I don't know what to call that.
Yeah, it's a Renaissance trope as well, so yeah, you're not wrong. There's a lot more people involved in this. They've clearly taken off his clothes to rip him apart.
Yeah, I see his clothes on the ground. I know they're supposed to be flat on the ground, but someone doesn't understand perspective. They're trying.
It's floating. This is probably before perspective had its heyday, so yeah.
I mean, they did pretty good. Look, the individual pieces are drawn very nice. Everything looks like it's been poorly photoshopped together.
I have one more for you to look at. I have no explanation for this one. Are you ready?
Okay.
It's just really aggressive.
Does he have an angry benediction plate of another pope?
He does. He looks like a zombie, okay? Everything about it is weird.
The other pope or him?
Just the whole thing. The whole thing. Everybody looks like zombies.
Was it the angry benediction plate?
Not a clue. Like I said, I don't have an explanation for whose picture he's holding.
It might be Pontian.
Maybe.
It's a young man.
That's likely.
He's got a weird baby head.
He's real mad about holding it, though, so...
I think he's kind of got, like, an apathetic sort of face.
Maybe it's the fact that he's so gray that it's upsetting. Yeah, those don't affect his score, but they're there. So now you've seen all of the depictions of Hippolytus.
Tempus non pontificus.
He was anti-pope from 217 to 235 through the papacies of Calixtus, Urban, and Pontian.
Three whole popes.
Three whole popes, that's a lot. So that is a total of 18 years as anti-pope, which gives him a score of 4.5 for Tempus non pontificus. That's pretty good. 18 years. I'm impressed.
Considering we've been having our popes sitting around like 11, 15.
Yeah, he did pretty good.
Hey, so it's canon bonus round time. No fanfare.
Well, he is a saint, and when it comes to feast days... Conventionally, he shares August 13th as a feast day with Pope Pontian, which is also the apodosis of the Feast of the Transfiguration. However, he also has a Feast of St. Hippolytus, Pope of Rome, on January 30th in the Eastern Orthodox Church, which feels like they just really want to stick it to the Catholics, so they gave him his own Pope feast day. So they're totally going to give that to him, but he's a saint anyways. He is the patron saint of horses. There was even a church dedicated to him in Hertfordshire in England, where sick horses were brought for his blessing in the medieval period, according to Prudentius. He's also apparently the patron saint of Bibania in Italy. And then I saw it listed somewhere that he was the patron saint of prison guards, prison officers, and prison workers. But this is also credited to Saint Adrian of Nicomedia, so don't know. That was just a weird one.
Sometimes they just overlap saints.
Yeah, and I couldn't find it cross-verified anywhere or corroborated, so not giving him that one. He's definitely the patron saint of horses and Bibinia, so I think he's got enough. Well, let's look at his total score. He gets a total score of 21.5.
That's actually not a bad score, considering he is a lot higher than some of our popes have been over the past couple weeks.
Yeah. That leaves us to our final question. Pope or nope? We have to ask ourselves, is he better than the pope he was coming up against? And in this case, because of when he actually leaves the church, we are going to call that Calixtus. So,
yeah, because he was definitely better than the other two, but, like, he's head-to-head with Calixtus here.
Do you think he was better than Zephyrinus? Zephyrinus was pope for, like, 18 years and managed a pretty decent papacy there. I don't know. It's challenging. He definitely was more theologically impactful.
Yeah.
And again, we have Pope Pontian, who set a precedent in the church that was...
You're right.
And I know my answer here, so it depends on how you feel, because I don't think in any way, shape, or form he can compare with Calixtus, so there is a strong note from me.
He just went up against a hard hitter.
Yeah, he really did. But I think that's how he would have wanted it, because he's such a strong personality that he would have bowled over top of anyone else.
Yep. He's probably rolling in his grave, having lost to Calixtus yet again.
Yep. I think that would probably kill him a little bit inside, but...
He's already dead, though.
So that is our final outcome. You are a nope, Hippolytus. I feel really good about that. But fortunately for him, because of the way that our system works, and because he's the first one, he's in first place for antipopes. He scored really, really well. Let's compare him in scores to Calixtus and see how he did. Calixtus had him beat. Calixtus got a 38.75. They were, not even close.
Fair.
That wraps up Hippolytus for us. So since you're already on Patreon, thank you so much for supporting us and being here. We gave you a long one.
You would not be here if you didn't know who we were, so.
And if you are here by mistake, what happened?
How are you here?
So with that, we say thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
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 Bye-bye.
Oh.